This is Matt Wells at UN News. While senior Google executive and internet pioneer Vince Cerf has called for the introduction of smart regulation guardrails and improved digital education for tech professionals and the general public, as the UN published a landmark report on Monday towards creating a safer, more inclusive digital future for us all. Mr. Cerf is recognised as one of the internet's founding fathers, and in his role as chief internet evangelist at the web giant, he continues to play a high-profile role as a thought leader in the tech sector. He's also a member of the UN High-Level Panel on Digital Cooperation and was present at the launch of the panel's first report, The Age of Digital Interdependence. In an exclusive interview with UN News, he spoke to Conor Lennon shortly after the launch at UN headquarters in New York.
In spite of the fact that we see headlines repeatedly where people's privacy has been violated because someone broke into an account and got a hold of all kinds of information about them, in spite of all those headlines, I can't but believe that the internet and the World Wide Web, which sits on top of it, has induced an enormous sharing of information. Some people imagine that the internet and then the World Wide Web have introduced a new demand for critical thinking. In fact, information overload has been with us for quite a long time. Let me take you back to pre-internet days. Let's say it's the 1950s. You probably did not read every magazine that was published, watch every movie, watch every television show. And so we were already filtering the information that we chose to get access to. I can remember whenever I had questions, I had to either turn to my personal library or go to the library downtown to get answers. Today, I find myself turning to Google, not surprisingly, and doing a search, hoping to get some information. However, I'm also very aware of the fact that the information I get back comes from a broad range of sources. And no matter how hard Google might try to organize the response with what it hopes is the best value information, I still find myself always asking questions like, where did this come from? Is there any corroborating evidence? All the things you normally do to think critically about information that you're being offered. And so I hope everybody gets trained to do that as a matter of course.
What are you most afraid of?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the general brittleness of the online environment really, really worries me. It's all made out of software. And as a former programmer, I know how easy it is to write software that has bugs in it. And the problem with those bugs is mistakes, is that if they are discovered, they can sometimes be exploited. And so we find all kinds of hacking going on to take advantage of bugs that have become visible. There is also the possibility that the software simply won't work right. And here, the big worry is this so-called Internet of Things. These are devices that have software in them that makes the device function, animates the device, and also allows the device to communicate on the internet. So think of household appliances. I used to think it was a funny joke to say, the thing I worry about is 100,000 refrigerators attacking Bank of America. Well, I don't say that. That's not a joke anymore, because in fact, 500,000 webcams did attack Dine Corporation. And of course, they didn't make this up. The little webcams didn't decide one day to self-organize. Someone, a botnet herder, found that the webcams didn't have any access control on them, or alternatively, they had well-known usernames and passwords, and organized a botnet and then used it to do a denial of service attack against a company on the net, which had consequences because that company, Dyn Corporation, was doing domain name resolution for a whole lot of other companies, which meant they disappeared off the net in consequence of the denial of service attack against Uncorp.
You don't seem to have any fears about the technology. Your fears are more about the capabilities of the people using it and the people who are writing software. So to what extent is education a part of the report that you've written?
Education turns out to show up as the solution to everything. I mean, the report doesn't come down to this one point saying everybody should be educated, but there's no doubt that solving a lot of the problems that these technologies have introduced does involve education, whether it's educating the technological people or educating ordinary users to hazards that they should be aware of.
Are you optimistic about the future?
I am very optimistic about the future. I always have been. I wouldn't have gotten into this business 45 years ago if I didn't feel optimistic. I watched this system penetrate, from my point of view, a little slowly, right? We're only at 50%, and from my point of view, this is 45 years and counting. On the other hand, for most of the world, it's more like 1993 and counting, because that's when the web showed up. I have seen plenty of opportunity for infrastructure to be used and abused. And what we're seeing here is exactly what Shakespeare teaches us, which is why we still read the plays 400 years later. People have motivations that are quite diverse. Some of them do not have your best interests at heart. That, unfortunately, is the human weakness. And so once the general public got access to the internet and the World Wide Web, we were confronted with exactly that set of negative incentives that people have. And we can't undo that simply with technology. We literally have to decide either to prevent abuse using technical means or to tell people some of these behaviors are unacceptable in our society, and if we catch you, there will be consequences, post hoc enforcement. And there is a third thing we can do. We can tell people, don't do that, it's wrong. It doesn't solve all problems, but I would say we have all three of those mechanisms, technical means, post hoc enforcement, and moral suasion, to try to shape the way in which people behave.
The Secretary General today at the launch, during the web chat with Jack Ma and Melinda Gates, he mentioned power, and with great power comes the great potential for abuse of power.
That's right.
And we now are starting to see, I think, that the internet, the World Wide Web, is essentially a public utility. Standard Oil was broken up at the beginning of the 20th century because it was felt that you couldn't have one company which had such a potential stranglehold on oil. We now have essentially digital oil. We all need to use the World Wide Web, or 50% so far, but we are saying in the report that everyone should be online. So when do you think regulators will have the requisite knowledge and education to be able to, in a smart way, regulate the internet and the very small number of large companies that are currently dominating it?
Well, that's a fairly loaded question. First of all, I still consider the internet space to be very, very open to competition. You need to remember that companies that appear to have been at their peak have sometimes gone away.
AOL.
Yahoo and so on. And so I would be very careful about breaking things up just because somebody appears to be on top at the moment. The internet's, the platform itself is extraordinarily open. I mean, at Google, at least for just speaking for myself, I always imagine that there might be two guys just like Larry and Sergey in some dorm room somewhere who just figured out how to do things a lot better than we do. And so we're running like crazy to try to keep ahead, technologically speaking. You ask, though, about thoughtful guardrails, which I thought was a really useful term that shows up in the report. It's shown up in some of the dialogue. The idea that we have this powerful technology, but that since we know it can be abused, the question is what kinds of guardrails should we put in place? And to be quite honest with you, some of the abuses come from individuals, and some of the abuses come from institutions, whether it's private sector corporations or other public sector institutions. I think you can make up a number of examples of this question of power and abuse of power. What's interesting and what might not have come to your thought when you mention power, think about the power that the internet has given an individual. Think about abuse of that power for a moment. Think of what some people have chosen to do with the network, whether it's to send out spam or to send phishing emails telling you that it's a friend of yours who's trapped in London and their passport's been stolen and please send money. It's amazing what kind of capability the internet has given to individuals, let alone
to behave
institutions.
Badly.
I'm sorry?
To behave badly.
Yeah, exactly. So we have power tools that we've created. Now we have to ask ourselves, what rules should we apply to the power tools for all those who wield them, whether it's an individual or an institution or a corporation.
But that's my point, really. When we saw Mark Zuckerberg appear before Congress, it was clear from some of the questions he was being asked that there was perhaps a low level of understanding of what his product even was. And yes. How could you then expect people like that to be able to effectively legislate?
That's a very, very reasonable question to ask. There are perhaps several answers to that. One of them, of course, is to hope that the elected officials will turn to experts to try to get educated. The second suggestion is that maybe people who are familiar with this technology should consider becoming elected officials in order to make policy. And there has been an effort to try to get some more scientists to agree to undertake such a role. The third one might be generational. That is to say that as people become more and more familiar and use this technology and do choose to go into political life, that over a period of time, the people who don't have that background will have gone on to their great reward, and we will have elected a more knowledgeable collection of legislators.
How long do you think this will take when we have a global environment in which there is sufficient collaboration to be able to make effective regulation? Because this is transnational now. This is not limited to one jurisdiction or one country.
Well, that much is true. But I would also argue that there are, from the business point of view, there are rules that every business is asked to follow in every country in which it does business. The fact that you're multinational as a corporation does not exonerate you, it doesn't give you the freedom to break the law in each country in which you... It'd be a crazy business model to walk in and say, hi, my business model is to break your laws. We have an example of a company that kind of did that. I'm not sure I should mention the name of the company, but it had something to do with transportation and the gig economy. And so we can guess. Yeah, you can guess who that might have been. And that didn't work out too well. So I think it's very important not to discount the importance of the legal frameworks in which each company has to operate as it functions in each country. I mean, in Google, for example, if I've understood correctly, remember I'm just an engineer, but I expect that we have incorporated entities in each country. And in the course of incorporating that entity, it is signed up to follow all the laws of that country. So I don't think that nations are nearly as impotent as your question might imply. The mere fact of multinational operation of a corporation does not diminish a country's ability to establish ground rules.